just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Okay, and welcome to the historic episode 30 of the Noco Moto podcast. I'm your host, MotoG Pete, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yep.
Let's talk bikes. All right, so moving into things here early on, I want to do yet another listener update. I want to recognize that we have one, as far as I can tell, just one single lonely listener in New Zealand. I'm going to speak directly to you. Thank you. And, you know, if you can, recruit some others. I know it's difficult. It's not a hugely populated country. I mean, you know, you're not in the middle of nowhere, but I mean, geographically, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere. How many miles do you think it is from New Zealand to Australia? Just on the ocean, roughly. It's a ways. You know, it's not Hawaii to like LA, but I mean, it's out there, you know?
Well, it's definitely not Hawaii to LA since that's half the Pacific.
This is true. Right. But it's a little bit ways. You were flying the flag for your island, your country, and, you know, while you're not a statistically huge portion of the continent's listeners, you are important in your area. So keep it up. We're with you, man. All right. And then I noticed some listeners coming in from Farnham, which is southwest of London, not too far from Crawley or Horley, which are some places we know very well. And I want to say there's like three or four listeners that have popped up there, right? And I can't help but imagine that these are probably guys that, you know, James used to race with way back in the day, you know? Like, yeah. I just imagine these guys having just amazing conversations with each other. Like, oh, yeah. So we went into Crawley and we saw the new Jack Reacher film. You know? Like, you know, like, yeah, Ted thought it was right, but I thought it was brill. Well, good. You know, I love that. I love the way people speak there. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be riding bikes this weekend. It's going to be brill. So that's important. And then, but whilst, you know, UK definitely thumbs up with, new listeners, still trailing behind all the Commonwealths. What are you doing? I'm about ready to get my Union Jack tattoo removed. Okay. You were seriously letting me down here. You know, we've done a lot of talk about, what a serious motorcycle culture it is. You know, you gotta live up to your end of the bargain. Let's get some more recruits. Canada's kicking your ass. Australia's kicking your ass. And, you know, whilst our only New Zealand listener isn't necessarily kicking your ass in numbers, pretty much comes through on every episode now. So it's definitely up there in enthusiasm. So let's get your, look, we've already warned you to get your shit together. UK, you're now on notice. All right. All right. So moving on, email. Okay. We got an email from William here in Louisiana who I'm not sure how we're going to be able to link this picture, but you're the tech guy, so you can figure that out. So we asked you guys for suggestions on the worst bike in the world. Well, we got this from William, which he's in Louisiana. He calls this a Cajun trike. This is a Facebook Marketplace ad that he's put up for us. Oh, where do we start? So this looks like a early 90s Suzuki Katana 750. All of the bodywork has been removed except for the very back end of the tail with the brake light and the grab bar. It has the Remus fake carbon fiber 4-into-1 exhaust on it. Actually, the exact same exhaust that we have on the Monster that we got. It's got a painted red rim. I don't know why. I guess to match the grab bar. All the other bodywork has been removed, including the tank. And then affixed to the front of it is the front half, not even the front half, but the front wheels and bodywork of some sort of four-wheeler ATV. okay.
You know what offends me about this bike more than anything else? It's the fact that this guy has clearly gone to a lot of trouble.
Oh yeah.
to put the front end of a four-wheeler on this bike, to turn it into some weird off-road Can-Am bullshit thing. And yet he couldn't do the most basic mod that would make this better, which is to go dark side and put a car tire on the rear wheel.
Yeah.
Because having rounded tires is going to do nothing for you on a three-wheeler.
Now, I've seen a lot of bullshit trike conversions. A lot of them. And I've seen a couple on the level of how bad this one is, but I've never seen one done quite this way. And the Cajun trike is the perfect way to describe it. This is, you know, the katana mixed with a four-wheeler. I mean, that's so special brand of white trash in every direction, forwards and backwards. It's absolutely wonderful that way. What I'm kind of curious, because it looks like the gas tank on this is neither the gas tank of the katana or the four-wheeler. I mean, it could be the gas tank from the four-wheeler, but I don't know why it was bothered painted black then, rather than just being the original red color. That's a little interesting to me. I'm wondering what this is for. Is that just the air box? No, that's a gas tank. Look at the screw cap on the top and everything. That's just
a
gas
tank. But is most of that, of what we can see there, the gas tank, and they just took the cover off of what covered the airbox and the gas tank?
I believe there is no airbox on this contraption. These carbs are just breathing easy. That's what I think is happening here. So I'm worried about, like, you know, okay, so, all right. They want $1,650 for this piece of crap, right?
But which would be optimistic in Denver.
Would be optimistic anywhere, because this can't be road legal because it doesn't have lights, right? So it must be for off-road use. But there's no drive to the front wheels, so you're relying on the standard motorcycle sport road tire for off-road grip. So this, you know, if this was, like you said, if they'd put the car tire on the back and it was a chunky off-road tire or something, okay, you've got some sort of really weird contraption. I mean, it's still useless off-road because, you know, how you deal with ruts and things, you know, you've got three wheels tracking on the ground. It's useless, but whatever. But this is neither good on road or off road. So I'm super confused. And there's no way it's road legal because it doesn't have lights. It doesn't have turn signals. It doesn't have a lot of basic things that you need.
I'm pretty sure 90% of Louisiana, legality or roadworthiness don't really apply.
Yeah, I'm guessing the guy that built this probably plays a little fast and loose with just the status of his driver's license in general. So how legal the vehicle he's on probably doesn't play real big into what's going on. But yeah, we're going to have to find a way to just post this in the show notes, because there's really not much we can say except wow. But thank you, William. This was interesting to look at, to say the least. Now, moving on to a different email. This one's from Nashville, or at least the Nashville area, from Brian. Okay, so Brian says, "Hey, guys. Like many of your new listeners, I discovered you through Bruce Phillips' podcast, and I'm so glad that I did. Bruce does a great job." And he certainly does. We love his show. But he says, "But I like to cuss and drink beer, so you guys are more my speed. I've listened to every episode." Thank you, Brian. Says questionable things about you. They've listened to every episode, but okay. "I'm 45 years old and live in Nashville, Tennessee area. I only recently started riding, and by that, I mean I took the MSF course in April of this year and have since logged a little over 3,000 miles. okay, respectable amount of miles in that amount of time. So he says, I initially bought a 2018 BMW G310R as a quote starter bike, but quickly regretted it due to the lack of power. When I went to the dealer for my 600 mile service, I saw a 2016 R1200 RS with 280 miles on it. The bike had sat in the shop for nearly 2 years until someone finally bought it. When the buyer's check bounced and he never made a payment, the dealer repossessed it. I took the bike for a test ride and traded for it on the spot. A financially moronic decision, I know, but I basically got a new R1200 RS for a used price. He says, keep in mind to this point, I had ridden almost exactly 600 miles on a motorcycle in my entire fucking life. Nevertheless, I thought it would be a good idea to jump instantly from 34 horsepower and 21 foot-pound of torque to 125 horsepower and 92 foot-pound of torque. But it has not been a problem. I have since put over 2,500 miles on the RS, including a 600-mile trip out of state, and I absolutely love it. I commute 40 miles round trip to work on the bike when it's not 1,000 degrees outside, and I otherwise ride it as much as possible. I'm very comfortable on it. And then he says, here's the issue. In so many ways, this has been the absolute perfect bike for me. I much prefer sport bikes over cruisers, but I also want a bike I can take on extended trips with features like cruise control, shaft drive, shift assist, heated grips, traction control, etc. This bike literally checks all those boxes. But at 520 pounds wet and with a flat twin engine suited more for touring, the RS really isn't scratching my sport bike itch. I'm highly tempted to make another financially moronic decision and sell it or trade the RS for a new sport bike. I'm thinking S1000RR, CBR1000RR, R1, or something similar. Another option would be to wait a while longer, keep the RS, and try to find a gently used or new old stock 600 bike. I'm not much of a wrencher and have very little free time to work on a bike. So I would need something super reliable and ideally still under warranty. And then I do like this. At the end, he says, a third option would be to stop being a little bitch and just enjoy the amazing sport tour I'm already lucky enough to own. What should I do? Brian from Franklin, Tennessee. All right. So there's a lot here. Starting right off here, the BMW, pretty good bike. I haven't ridden one, but I've heard great things from people who have, right? I don't think they're super cheap. I want to say they're somewhere between $6,000 and $7,000. But
for it, what?
The BMW 310.
They're $4,750 brand new.
No way. Are they that cheap? Okay.
Okay. Well, we'll get into that bike later. Okay.
Yeah, we'll get into that later. But so are we going to get into it later? Did you just tip your hand? All right. So that bike, by all accounts, a great bike. And not a bad way to go when you're starting. It sounds like you got some disposable income. Just by the vibe of this email, I'm thinking no kids. I'm thinking a little free and easy, pretty decent working hours. You know, we got a little shot from his office window looking down into Nashville. Like, I think Brian's doing all right for himself, right? This is a new hobby and he's hitting it hard. And I fucking love that, right? 3,000 miles. You know, your first few months riding, essentially, that's a very respectable number of miles. Like, no problem there. You know, I think you're getting into this, you're hitting it hard, and that's great. Now, moving up to the R1200, sounds like you got a pretty good price on one. And that is an amazing, amazing bike. It really is. And 125 horsepower and the 92 foot-pounds of torque. I don't know exactly how much of that makes it to the back wheel, but still a fuck ton, right?
Well, just think straight 15 to 20% more torque than the Norge.
Right. And then you've got there's something about this bike that isn't really scratching it for you. Now, the R1200 RS is a fairly sporty bike, right? If you're looking at sports tourer bikes, this one, by today's standards, leans a little bit further, slightly further towards the sport than it does the touring.
I would go the other way around.
You think?
This is more touring bike made a little bit more sport, made slightly sporty, as opposed to sport bike escalated up into, you know, escalated up. You know, it's not like an ST1300.
Right.
It's more classic tourer made. It's more like a cruiser made standard with performance.
I disagree. Let's bring up a picture of one here. This is...
Oh, okay.
Right. It's not like an ST1300 where, you know, it's the full
I'm an idiot.
This is...
Oh, I'm an idiot. I thought this was... For some reason, I glazed over and saw G1200RT. No. This is fairly sporty.
Right. This has got handlebars very similar to, like, the height and position that you'd find, like, on my Superhawk, really.
Right.
This isn't full-on RR spec race bike sort of crouch down position, but this is not necessarily the most comfortable sport touring position you've ever seen in your life, right? And, you know, from 99.9% of all people on this planet, they're going to look at this and kind of think, oh yeah, sort of Japanese crotch rockety. And that's what they're going to think, you know? It's important to keep in mind that most people don't know shit about motorcycles, right? 50% of all people here in the States just only know about Harleys. Outside of that, their knowledge base is nothing.
And right? To them, if they saw an Indian Scout, they would say, oh, Harley.
Right. So this is just some sort of sport thing to anyone who, unless they are, you know, they ride something other than a Harley. So already we're getting down to about like what, like 6% of the population tops. On top of that, they're familiar with the differentiation of Japanese bikes and European bikes, sports bikes, sport touring, and all of that. Like, no, this is a fast bike, any way you cut it. Now, a lot of elitists might be like, no, seriously, dude, the R1200, it's a pig. Shut up. This is a fast bike. Anything over 90 horsepower making it to the rear wheel is fast in my book, right? Mm-hmm. So, Brian, here's the thing. This bike that you own is way better than you are. I know you've done over 3,000 miles since April, and that's a lot. You're riding a lot, obviously. You're commuting a lot of days, if not every day. You've taken the 600-mile trip. You feel comfortable on the bike. Everything's working, and all of a sudden, like, you feel like you've got to keep this train of escalation going, right? I don't think you need a new bike. Like you said, this bike ticks all the boxes. What I think you need is a track day. Because this bike is so much better than you are. And let's keep in mind, you're 45. Statistically, this is not a good age to be when you're looking at the possibility of crashing. All right? Like 45 to 55 right now is where like everyone's wrecking their fucking motorcycles and dying. Sturgis just ended. I don't know how many people exactly died at Sturgis, but like 700 or something like that. Like it's crazy. You don't need a faster bike. This bike is way better than you. This bike is so much sportier than you realize. So I think two directions. One, well, you need a track day either way. And, you know, if you're not afraid to do a little damage to this bike, then take this bike. But I think your other direction is you need to get a shitbox already crashed or scratched up Ninja 250. And you can do track days on that. And I think the amount that taking some instruction on a super shitty 200. I mean, the thing can be fucking stolen, literally stolen. It doesn't matter because you won't plate it. You won't have to put it in your name. It will only exist for you to take to the track and get some instruction on. And after getting some things like that down, you'll realize how much, you'll just realize how sporty the bike you already have actually is. Because it is overkill for the regular roads. It's absolutely overkill. You could have the S1000RR, or you could have a Ninja H2R or whatever, and just some asshole that's done a couple track days on your BMW will just destroy you on regular roads or a track or whatever, you know? You're running into a little area where it's important to keep in mind that you still don't know very much, right? And this is not trying to belittle or demean anything because, you know, like I said, you've already done an incredible amount of riding for the short amount of time you have been riding. And hats off to you. Fucking badass, right? Like that, that's wonderful. You're on the right track there. Just nothing but big thumbs up from us there.
So I actually have an alternate theory and a much simpler solution.
What's that?
Seeing that Brian came from a 310R with its 34 horsepower and 21 foot-pounds of torque.
Yeah.
The reason I think he thinks this bike is lethargic and toury and old man is because he's probably short-shifting the fuck out of it.
He might be. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Brian, what I will say is when you get onto the highway, start shifting around 6,000 RPM and see how it feels then. Because I think that what's probably happening here, because, I mean, when I first got the Norj, you know, outside of the test ride, I realized I was shifting around 3,000 RPM, which is kind of really just the beginning of the torque curve.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a box twin. So this thing, probably, if he's shifting around similar kind of feel to as he was on the 310, then he's probably only ever got maybe 40 foot-pounds of torque out of that motor, and it just sits, you know, at 3,500 RPM on the highway in sixth gear. So I think, try and just ride the bike you have a little more spiritedly. Don't take risks, but just start shifting later and really start wringing the power out of it. Now, it may be good. I don't think you need to get a track bike because I think, you know, as you said in your email, you're saying you're not much of a wrencher. But if you can find somewhere where you can go do a track day class and just do a weekend of lessons, I think that would be a shit ton of fun.
Yeah. Now, there is another option, which is you could go for a K1200 RS, the 2006 and later, I believe, which is a similar bike to yours, but a BMW inline four across the frame. It's not the R1000 double S, like essentially just a track bike. It's a little bit more sport. It's sport tourer-y in exactly the same way your current bike is, but just styled a little more sport and whatever. But I'd stick with the bike that you have. It's already unusable horsepower for the real world. It really is. So yeah, shift later, take a track day. And if you really get into track, get a Ninja 250 and thrash the fuck out of that thing. Because nothing will make you a better rider early on than just taking a super small bike and really learning what the kind of limits are there. And then it'll give you this whole new appreciation for the other machine that you have. To know what you can actually do on a smaller bike with skill added. So there we go.
And again, I will just say, if you still feel like you want something a bit sportier, then what I would say is, even if you do end up thinking, what I really want is a super sport, at the very least, hang on to the bike you have for another 6 months.
Yeah, do our two bike system. Like, you know, just tell your, get another one and then just promise yourself you're only going to renew the insurance on one of them.
Which isn't a huge risk, because if you're getting rid of, if you end up getting rid of the BMW, they hold their value super well.
Yeah, well, you already bought it a little bit depreciated, so.
Or maybe even, maybe, you know, the biggest loss really is going to be, you know, a little bit of depreciation plus, you know, your insurance and your registration. So kind of work yourself towards a decision point on when the registration expires.
Yeah. All right. I think we nailed that. So that brings us to something we're going to talk about. I've been interested in the idea of how just escalation in motorcycles in general. And this was really brought up by Brian's email to we. It was like, okay, this is the week we have to talk about it. Because we've got, like, you know, this ongoing list of things that we want to talk about, and we're constantly texting, emailing back and forth. What are we going to talk about? And there's so many subjects that have just been thrown to the side for weeks and weeks. But this is the time to talk about escalation. So when you're riding in general, you start with something smaller or at the very least cheap. Even if it is a large engine, people tend to get a hold of something with a big engine that's still not even making a lot of power, right? They'll be like, oh, my first bike was a GS850, you know, which by modern standards aren't making a huge amount of power or whatever it is, right? And then there's this idea that if either in just straight up displacement or horsepower or weight in some way, it's always going bigger and bigger and bigger with every bike. And a lot of people do this very quickly early on. Some people do it slowly over the years. Some people have just, they buy a 500, they ride it for 10 years, and then they get something that's like, you know, they get a Busa or something out of nowhere, right? There's all sorts of different ways that it happens. But I'm kind of curious why. Because I'm one of those people that did a very different thing. I got a 650 Nighthawk to start with. I got the CB900 after that. And then I went down to the CB350. And I remember, like, the day after I got it, I took it by my buddy's dad's house. The thing wasn't running. I mean, I bought it in boxes. You know, it was all taken apart. But I remember taking it by his place because he was in the middle of restoring a Bonneville T110 Tiger at the time, one that he'd bought from new way back in the day. And he'd bought it back from the second owner who he'd sold it to in like 1983 or something like that, right? And so I was just talking to him about what it was going to take, what about this and everything. And I still had the CB900 with me, and he sort of like, you know, kind of took notice, and he goes, oh, 900 down to the 350. And he looked at me and he said, you've progressed a level. And I really didn't know what he meant for a while. Cause I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, this bike by all means is inferior to the CB900. You know, it doesn't, you know, I was like, the CB900's got like the air ride suspension, which was supposed to be better. I mean, I didn't know that the air ride suspension was complete shit, but it's supposed to be a better system. I'm like, the CB900 has better brakes. It's got more power, more cylinders, more, you know, better carburetors. It carries more fuel. It has more creature comforts. Like, what do you mean? Like, I'm taking a step down. And what he meant was, I'd found a bike that I was going to enjoy for just exactly what it was.
Right.
I clearly, because I was going down in power, wasn't expecting something new out of it in terms of speed or performance. I was looking at the bike for exactly what it was going to be. Now, when people go up, you know, they're looking, it's like, you know, it's like a heroin addict has to keep taking more and more heroin to keep getting high, right? You know, they're building up a tolerance to the acceleration, to the speed, to the experience of riding the bike. And it's like, oh, I've got to have the new thing to sustain this high I get while I'm riding. But I don't think that's everyone either.
I think it is for a lot of people. I mean, I think a lot of people get into motorcycles and they have this one particular idea of what they want. And then they'll pick a bike that does that one thing that they really want. And then if they haven't really gotten a lot of experience on it and they want to escalate quickly, they'll try and get more of the same thing. It's kind of like, you know, when you go to the movies as a six-year-old, it's you know, Batman, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and all I want is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 and Batman 2 and Batman 3, 4, and 5.
Right.
And more of the same.
Right.
Bigger, better. But I think if you are kind of forced to stick with the bike for a while, you kind of figure out more what you like out of that bike. And you can kind of perceptualize what do you actually want out of your bike.
Well, yeah. The reason I want to talk about this so much more is, you know, with Brian's email, it's this amazing little case study because all sorts of different angles are brought up here. Because he got the small bike and then, you know, the 310R, he literally just got jump to the biggest version of that in the R1200 RS, right?
Right.
It's the same thing. I mean, it's not the same thing. It's a different frame and all of that. But in BMW sort of, you know, sport lineup, he just, okay, here we go. Yeah. Of course, the most insane one's the S1000, I know. But in sort of in terms of that philosophy of bike, he just, you know, went, boom, here's a bigger step, right? And he did it quickly, right? Now, was that because I mean, he only did 600 miles, right? If it's your first bike, 600 miles, I don't know if that's quick enough to get bored of a motorcycle. I really don't think it is. Maybe it is. I don't know. Yeah, maybe Brian is just living on the edge every day. And he really – and maybe legitimately he was getting bored of it. I don't know. But I think a lot of people go up. They escalate for a social pressure. And I wonder what that had an influence there as well, right? He's taken his bike in for service. He bought it new and everything. Are there other people around the dealership? Has he been talking with people? And are they, you know, did someone say to him, like, oh, the 310, yeah. Yeah, those are good for beginners. And that was just like, you know, got in his head and started festering and bothered him every time he went back to the dealership to like buy some gloves or get some oil or do whatever it was. And he's like, oh, it's the starter bike. I got to get off of this thing. I've got to get off of this thing and onto something bigger so I can get more respect. Right. You know, cause the dude's riding a lot. Right. And he's starting to feel like he's a real rider. Well, dude, you're a real rider from day one. Okay. And, you know, this doesn't happen just in this world. Let's look at Harleys, right? You know, so the Sportster, oh, that's the beginner's bike. That's the girl's bike, you know? When are you going to get a real bike?
When are you going to drop $16,000 more dollars
right.
and get 20 more horsepower?
Right. It's weird because there's this escalation that happens, right? So in the Harley world, it's not even just for performance, you know, because if you want the fastest Harley, it's the V-Rod or the 1200 Sportster or a Breakout, I guess. But even the Breakout, you know, I don't know. It's just sort of just in terms of general size there, right? Like some people just even escalate up to the trike because it's physically larger and therefore more impressive in their eyes, right? So we've determined that some people will escalate for just the performance because they need that drug. And some people will escalate from a social pressure, like a feeling of inadequacy because they don't think that their bike is viewed the right way. It doesn't match their mental image of how they think they are as a writer, right?
Right.
And on a certain level, I very much agree with that, because why are you writing if you don't feel cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we accept risk when we ride. And, you know, the fun is a big trade-off that makes that acceptance possible. But also so is the, I was about to say like a feeling of self-worth, but that's complete bullshit. No. There's something about, you know, how cool you can feel on it. There's a certain thing with your ego and the experience and a sense of like accomplishment and mastery that all forms together that just clicks when you're on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel like the bike is inadequate, then all of a sudden you don't feel cool anymore. And if you're not feeling cool, then you definitely shouldn't be accepting the risk, right? I mean, the most risky things that guys have ever done in the world was to look cool in front of women, right? Like, looking cool in front of chicks or other dudes is like the biggest reason guys accept risk ever. You know, like, hold my beer, right? I'm going to do this cool fucking shit. That's why we do it. So right. If you don't feel cool on the bike, then I understand it. I don't necessarily agree with it. I sort of agree with it, but I understand why people escalate for that reason. And then some people will just escalate just to outdo someone else. And that's the really dangerous one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that's the one that ends in someone getting the freewheeler, because it just like limits the way they can ride and maybe potentially hurt themselves. I don't know, but I've just got to get this bigger thing because my buddy got this, right? But that's quite often where you run into the situation of like, oh, I started off with, you know, this used Ducati 900, and then my buddy got, you know, an 800 Panigale, and then I had to go and get a 1200 Multistrada, and it keeps going up. And then people very quickly run into a situation where they have very little experience and a lot of on-demand power.
Right.
And I'm not saying that everyone that's, you know, moving up is doing that. In fact, most people probably aren't, but several people are. And I think it's worth looking at why we need to escalate so much, because in terms of a practical vehicle, you start getting diminishing returns as soon as you cross about 55 horsepower. And then that curve drops in terms of what you're getting for your money even more sharply after about 90 horsepower.
Right. So, yeah, it is an interesting thing. And it's something that, for what I get out of riding, seems like most of the motivations that I've seen for this and what people have told me in terms of what bikes they're getting and what their motivations are, it seems counterintuitive to what motorcycling is to me. In that, you know, to me, riding is one of those things where, and this is just kind of the way I approach it, is, you know, you'll do things like drive through a red light, you know, a second after it's turned. You'll drive through a light a second after it's turned red in a car,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Or I'll just assume that this person turning onto the road where I have right of way won't do it, because if he does, well, fuck him. It's his insurance. He'll be at fault. So whatever. Whereas on a motorcycle, you know, you can say, well, you know, you had the right of way, and we'll inscribe that on your tombstone.
Yeah.
Where it's not just accepting responsibility for yourself. It's recognizing that there's a lot of fucking idiots around you. And to make everything go right for you, you have to be responsible for everyone that's around you and all of their fuck-ups.
I can sum this up perfectly. Right before I got here, when I was on 6, when I in between. So right as I was getting on to six, headed towards here. So I was still on Sheridan, and all of a sudden this Bentley. What's the Bentley coupe? Like the hot Bentley sports coupe car?
I have no idea.
And it's like the Continental, but it's the two-door, small, super fucking fast, like gigantic engine in this thing, right? It looks kind of like a BMW, what's the Z car thing that they did, like the James Bond one.
Mm.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Super fast Bentley just decides to blow by me just super fast, right? And then he's held up by traffic. And I don't know why, but for a moment, I got triggered. And I was like, oh, no, buddy. Now, I've got this 2003 carbureted Honda V-twin, right? Which not most sport bike people, why do I keep doing that? But a lot of people might consider not necessarily all that fast by today's standards, you know? It's like 115 horsepower, but 107 is getting to the back wheel, but it's big torque, but whatever. And I just went like, I don't think so, buddy. I've still got a better horsepower to weight ratio. I'm going to fucking show you what's up. And we weren't full on racing, but like, you know, I would weave through a little bit of traffic and I'd get ahead and then he'd find some gaps and he'd sort of blow me off and whatever. And at some point, like, you know, it started at like 60 miles an hour, then to 70, then to 80, then to 90. And at a certain point, I was like, holy crap, I'm doing 115 on six. This is a 65 mile per hour zone. Nothing I've done seemed all that insane to me at this point, but I am now noticing this getting away from me. And then I just let him go. I just let him go. And, you know, I don't know if the Bentley is a better top speed than my bike. I know I had better acceleration than him, although he had acceleration that was very close to mine. But, you know, you've kind of got to get into, you know, upwards of $150,000 to $200,000 in a car to approach the level of performance that wasn't even top of the line 15 or 20 years ago in sport-ish motorcycles, right? If you've got 90 horsepower, you're faster than everybody around you, like just pretty, like 99.9% of the time. So when you're going past that, you know, it's important to think about why you're doing it and for what purpose, you know. Is it because you like how the rest of the power band of that bike is below that point that you're making, you know, upwards of 100 horsepower? Because, you know, once you're asking your bike to make more than 90 horsepower, you're going faster than 100 miles per hour. That's just the plain facts.
Well, yeah. I mean, most of the time you might be making 80 horsepower in first gear on a Gixxer 750 doing 65 miles an hour in first gear. But it is one of those things where unless you're pulling away and accelerating as quickly as you can, or you're on the drag strip, I doubt that more than 0.001% of the time an R1 is making close to peak horsepower.
Yeah.
Maybe even less. But there's a combination of, do you really need more power? Is it just not doing it for you? Or is there a perception that you have of yourself that makes you feel more badass when you have the super bike over the super sport and getting a bit more torque and you just like how the torque feels? Or is it the way you feel about yourself given how you perceive that other people perceive you?
Right. And I'm definitely not saying that any of these things are right or wrong, because I definitely see a way that all of these are legitimate. And that sounds weird, but I always say you have to feel cool on the bike. Otherwise, why would you accept the risk of riding the bike in the first place? I totally get it, but you know,
I would also say that, like, you know, if you just want to have the R1 because it's a lot more badass to have an R1 than an R6, that's kind of valid in the same way that having, like, a $2,000 suit is better than having, you know, a $200 suit from the men's warehouse.
Yeah, very few people can tell the difference, but when someone, you know, the twice a year someone does recognize the difference, maybe that makes all the validation in the world for you.
Right.
You know, or like, okay, so another weird thing that happened to me on the ride down here today. I'm in the middle of Greeley, and I'm coming up, and there's this sidecar rig in front of me. And I'm like, what is that? Oh, that's old. Or is that like a Ural? No, it's not a Ural. Like, oh, is that an Enfield? No, no. And then I pull up next to him, and it's a BMW R60. Now, this is a red light conversation, so I had to, like, get – so I just flip up my visor. You know, I'm like, is that an R60? You know, and I mean, I knew it was an R60, but it was so perfect. I didn't know if, like, maybe it was a kit bike or something like that. You know, it was so perfect. It looked newer than new, right? And the guy, you know, clearly he was like in his like late 60s or something. And this guy had been riding a long time, and, you know, he very much had the, there's a certain look, you know, from guys that age, you know, the jeans with the cuffs of them folded up, and the white t-shirt and the sneakers and the 3/4 helmet with the plastic, you know.
Yeah.
He was dressed like, you know, he'd been riding since he was a teenager. And, you know, he sort of looked around, and, you know, when I said, is that an R60? And he looks around and he sees me, and like this incredibly puzzled look on his face. And he goes, well, it is, you know, and then he just started he's like, you know, BMWs. I was like, yeah, I do, you know, and he just starts spouting. He's like, all these /5 models and blah, blah, blah. He was still rattling off bikes that he's had and restored as like he was pulling away and turning left and I was going straight, you know, but I could tell it, like, it made his year.
Yeah.
Because the bike he was on fit who he was, and he walks around all day or riding it just hoping someone will recognize, and I did, and that was like everything in the world that he needed, right it completed him. The shock on his face that I recognized it, and, you know, and like I said, I would have said like, oh, you've obviously spent a shit ton of time restoring this and whatever, and that would have like filled him up even more. But just the fact that this dude that didn't look the part to him, wasn't on the vehicle that was the part to him, you know, just bridging that world, and in that moment just going, is that an R60? And him just be like, yes. And just him totally just completely validated and shocked that he was. He'd been going a long time, you know, feeling just cool to himself on the inside, but obviously not getting a whole lot back on that, you know? And for some people, the R1 is that bike that does that. You get on it and you just feel right because you're like, yeah, you know, I'm going to get around to doing that track day, but inside I know I'm that guy, right? Like, I get that, you know? You haven't gotten around to it yet. You probably are aware that the bike is better than you are. But then at least in the meantime, you know that you can ride to you're 100% sure you can ride to the level and ability that you at least currently have. The bike's definitely not going to let you down, right?
Mm-hmm.
You may not know just how many times over that bike is better than you are, but whatever. You know for certain that you've got the kit to get done what you need to get done, and you feel cool on the bike. And I get that, but I don't know. I just feel like everyone, it's worth taking stock. You know, when you think about what your next bike is and what you're currently on.
But there's also
are really the motivations?
There is also, you know, something to keep in mind, which is, you know, if you're riding a Gixxer 600 and you think you need the 1000, you know, rather than thinking, I've got to get the 1,000, there is very much this Taoist perspective shift that you can have that will instantly solve a $6,000 problem in your life.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Understanding that your current 600 Gixxer is limited to 167 miles per hour and capable of more, you can save yourself a lot of money, dude. Like,
right.
You know? Okay. I might have some more thoughts on this later, but I think I've kind of said all I need to say about it right now. Just, yeah, and just sort of closing on this part, you know, escalation. In general, I'm a fan of it, but I think it's just always worth for everybody just on their own time to really sit and meditate on exactly why they are gonna go for something bigger. And when you come up with a reason that's good enough for you, then I'm on board. Get a bigger bike, bro. Cause at the end of the day, getting a bigger bike is fucking awesome.
It's a lot of fun.
All right. Let's take a break here. All right, we're back, and as always on the show, we're going to do best worst bike in the world this week. Now, our usual disclaimer: if we have chosen a bike that you owned or want to own, don't get your feelings hurt. There'll be a new worst bike next week. Or, you know what, if you think our best bike in the world is pretty lame, you know what, it's just a fun way to look at a couple different bikes in a different way than you might normally. So, brief discussion, explanation. We each choose a new bike every week, each of us, alternating best and worst. We have no idea what the other has chosen, although Swiggy might have tipped his hand earlier in the episode on this one this week. And let's get into it. So, as always, Swiggy goes first, and this week you have worst bike in the world. Is that correct?
Yep.
All right, reveal it. And the worst bike in the world this week is
the BMW G310R.
Okay. Let's look up the specs. Okay, so what are we dealing with here?
So, first of all, sorry, Brian, but you got a little bit suckered here.
Okay,
so, as Brian already mentioned in his email, Spike makes 34 horsepower, 21 foot-pounds of torque, and it's in a sort of beginner, naked standard style.
Right.
Thing to keep in mind, this bike is $4,750.
Which is a cheap and cheerful, yeah, no problem price for an entry-level bike.
You would think. However, this bike makes the same torque and two less horsepower than a 1970 CB350.
No.
Yes.
Now, I know the CB350 claimed 36, but in my experience, they were never really making more than 24, 28. But
it's in the same ballpark, because you have to remember, this is a 310cc single.
Right, and four valve, which, well, yeah. Yeah, okay.
So, on top of that, you also have to look at the fact that for $5,000, you could get an R3
mm-hmm.
or a Ninja 400 making 10 more horsepower and 6 more foot-pounds of torque.
Yeah. Now, that's where this comes into play.
And both of those bikes are fully fared.
What also makes more power for the same price is the KTM 390.
Yes, which also makes 44 horsepower.
And has similar styling and all of that. So you're kind of just paying for the BMW badge on this one.
But it's also not a bike that really gets you into the BMW. This bike gets you into the BMW club as much as a Street 500 gets you into the Harley club.
Right. Yeah. it's the new kid on the block, so there's no one that remembers having one or one similar to it or anything like that. Yeah.
On top of that, at this price, at this price range and this level of entry, there's no reason not to go Japanese.
Agreed.
Because overall, the Japanese bikes are more reliable, even than BMW. You get the insane aftermarket options and the much better parts support.
That's a big one. Yeah, I mean, BMW parts support is good, but it's definitely not what the Japanese stuff is going to get you in this country. Definitely not.
Right. Also, this is clearly a bike that BMW doesn't really care about too much. First of all, if you go to BMW Motorrad,
right,
and look at the copy for this bike.
Mm-hmm.
The title thing, the subtitle of the description is "Good Jeans, Good Looks." First of all, Germany, settle down here.
Yeah,
there's a little and
good jeans and good looks. Okay, I'll give it to you that, you know, BMW has been in the game as long as anyone. A great history of, and I don't know, people say, you know, BM trouble use and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, over time, actually a very good record of reliability over time. You know, in the 60s, it was like, oh, yeah, buy a BMW. It'll never break. I mean, it would break all the time, but that just meant it would break down way less than everything else, which broke down just every other day.
So they are trying in the description. So the first line of the description here, the copy,
mm-hmm.
Good looks, unmistakably run in the family. The G310R clearly carries the S1000R genes.
Yeah.
Maybe. Settle down here. Okay, first of all, second line. The sporty headlight fairing with powerful headlight, dynamic fuel tank trim, and typical roadster proportions transform it into an eye-catcher on the street. If the first thing that you're going to advertise about your bike is its powerful headlight, the shape of the tank, and its proportions, which define just kind of what class or style the bike is in, you can't have a lot going for you here.
Yeah, it kind of needs to be a bike that's just only going for style, like, let's say, the new Bonnevilles, right? You know, the Bonneville can trade on tank shape and a better headlight and letting people know what the bike is from a mile away, because that's the whole point of the bike. This is supposed to be a sporty, engaging starter bike, you know, user experience.
And this bike is not easily identified as a BMW at a distance.
It's true. Yeah. If this was like a 310, like GS adventure bike or something like that, then maybe they could have a point there. But not as a sport bike of some description.
So there is this kind of, as you scroll down on the page on the BMW Motorrad website,
mm-hmm.
there are some very suspect things that they're clinging to, that they're advertising. Because, you know, whenever you get down to this size bike, you're trying to play up things that aren't all that special, in the same way that, you know, if you're selling a shitbox car, you're going to have, you know, front discs and rear drums, and you're going to say front disc brakes.
Yeah.
And just ignore the fact that it has rear drum brakes.
Yeah.
Because it's a piece of shit because it's cheap, but you're working with what you've got.
Yeah.
So three of the things that are being advertised on the 310R.
Okay.
In this kind of tiles description they've got here. Gold anodized upside down forks.
Okay, yeah. At this point,
which tells me that they're not Showas or anything special. They are just inverted forks that are gold anodized.
Right. Now, okay, look, even on like 600s or even leader bikes, unless you are actually riding on the track constantly, inverted forks are pointless unless you're really riding that bike hard. Now, on, again, the race spec bikes, the super sports and the super bikes, I get it, because the bike needs to be capable of that should one day you decide to start doing that with the bike. Okay. Outside of that, there's zero reason to have inverted forks on anything. No one needs that kind of rigidity. No one's doing that kind of riding on regular roads. And you know what? Even at like the smaller level of these bikes and everything, like when you are taken to the track, you just don't need that.
This is true.
So it's purely a styling thing. So I'll give it a little bit of a pass on the fact that they aren't Showas or any, you know, thing hot to talk about. You know, the bike's a small bike. It's built to a price point. What is sad is that the bike is so unremarkable that they have to resort to this kind of gimmicky thing to sell it to you.
So here's the next one.
Okay.
Gold brake calipers.
Okay, that's some Harley Davidson bullshit right there.
What's even better is that if you look at the actual brake calipers,
mm-hmm.
they're like Bibers, BYBRE.
Oh, no. Okay, so those are the Brembo off-brand.
Right.
Yes.
Which is clearly meant to just look very close.
Well, no, they're made by Brembo, but out of a different factory in like Taiwan or something like that.
Right.
And it's the knockoff. It is the, what's the off-brand of, okay, if Brembo in terms of brakes is Budweiser, the king of beers, these brake pads are a Busch Light.
Right.
I think that's how you describe this.
Right. And this is kind of the bare minimum you need for a new bike today, but this has to be played up as a feature. But now, here's my favorite one.
Okay.
Actually, I've got one more before that.
All right.
Which is multifunctional display.
My 03 Nighthawk has a multifunctional display. It's carbureted.
Well, here's the thing. If you have a speedometer...
I mean, Superhawk. I said Nighthawk. Yeah. Whatever.
If you have a speedometer and a neutral light, you have a multifunctional display.
Multifunctional display. That just means you can toggle between, like, your different trip meters. Yeah, you know, like, that's... You can reset it with just holding a button down rather than twisting a mechanical dial to set it back to zero.
Here's my favorite.
Okay.
Innovative single-cylinder engine. Which I think is the bare minimum you need to have to be called an internal combustion engine.
Okay, look, when Honda put out the CBR 250 RR engine that was a 250 5-valve single cylinder, which was a prototype platform for all the Moto 3 bikes to be based off of, that was innovative, right? And then Escalation took over and it's like, all right, okay, and then Honda bumped it up some more CCs to like 289 or something like that, just to be able to call it a 300. But yeah, that's not innovative to have a 4-valve single. This has been happening in dirt bikes since 2005, right? That's not a big deal. Yeah, it does start to fall apart a little bit. Not in that it's necessarily a garbage bike, but BMW is struggling to market a entry-level bike and make that fit with their premium brand image.
Right.
So they have to oversell you on this rather than be straight up what it is. A very marginally cheaper, but slightly more inferior than the cost difference would suggest, entry-level 300.
Right. And again, here's the thing. unless for some bizarre reason, the only dealer within 100 miles of you happens to be a BMW exclusive dealer, or maybe a shop that only sells BMWs and Harleys. There's no reason you would ever choose this bike if you are informed of all of your options.
Exactly. Yeah, you put this next to an R3 on the showroom floor, and everyone goes for the R3 every day of the week.
Right.
I mean, the R3, oh God, we need to talk more about the R3 in a later episode, but I mean, it's the best looking 300. There's no question. It's the best performance. It's the best value for money.
I would say the Ninja 400 is better performance.
That's true, but if we just like rewind the clock, you know, to a year ago mm-hmm. or something, you know, within the 300 class, your bang for buck, and I don't know, I can't remember the MSRP of the 400 off the top of my head.
They're both 5,000.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. There's no reason not to go for the Ninja 400, but let's pretend the Ninja 400 doesn't exist and we're just simply sticking to the 300 class or thereabouts, you know? And let's just say anything under 399 and even include the KTM in there.
Right.
There's zero world in which this is the absolute best option. The only way this makes sense is if you're getting into bikes and all your friends already own BMWs. So you can just have the brand matching with them.
Right.
That's the only way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, because we were just talking like, you know, during the break in between these segments of, you know, why people escalate and whatever. And, you know, we were sort of talking about how rather than having the absolute fastest, best bike in the world, it's a lot cooler to have a bike that's the best in its class, right?
Right.
That's more bragging rights in the real world because, well, anyone can just come by with a Hayabusa or an H2R and be, or just reference those, right? Then someone doesn't have to own one. You can say, oh, I've got this bike that's so fast and powerful. And they'll be like, oh yeah, but the H2R, right? You know, the H2R is to the motorcycle world what the Bugatti Veyron was for a long time. It's just like no one, all of a sudden everyone's dick went limp because, well, the Veyron exists. So everything else is garbage, apparently. And it didn't matter that no one could afford a Veyron or even have the opportunity to buy one, even if they had the money to buy one. It didn't matter. That bike existed, right? And the H2R exists, which is the most stupid, out-of-this-world, crazy motorcycle ever. And deep down, I have to admit, it's fucking cool. But in terms of the real world, you know, it doesn't fit into a class. It doesn't fit into my life. It doesn't, you know, what's it really for, right?
Right.
Because you can't race it against anybody, so it doesn't matter how fast it is, right? So this thing on a track loses to everything else in the class. And, you know, am I going to say, like, as a new rider, does it matter if you have 34 or 36 horsepower? Not really. But what is important is because it's the lowest of the class, you're going to outgrow it that much quicker because you know you have no bragging rights. You're probably going to stick with an R3 a little bit longer because you know it has a reputation. You know it has some sort of street cred, which is probably why Brian moved so quickly from this and upped to the R1200 because he was like, I'm just so embarrassed to be seen on it. It didn't make him feel cool.
Well, also, and he said he had a 40-mile round trip to work.
Yeah.
Which has got to include a little bit of highway or at least some 55-mile-an-hour roads, which getting up to 55 and accelerating and overtaking on a 55 or 65-mile-an-hour road with 20 foot-pounds of torque, it's a little terrifying.
Yeah, you've got to ring it open for sure. And, you know, it's doable. And, you know, I've often actually said, like, these 300 class bikes aren't really the greatest beginner bikes because the power bands are very narrow and they do have a small amount of power, you always have to be riding with those revs right in the power band. And there's no room for error on your gear changes. And they're actually kind of more advanced bikes to ride. You can get yourself into trouble just by making mistakes in gear changes and where your shift points are.
They're good bikes if you just sit in the slow lane and everybody around you is a responsible driver.
In a higher speed situation, yes. I mean, in the middle of the city, all of these bikes are basically identical, and yeah. Who cares? They're all going to handle great, and they're going to look good and everything, and super cool, no problems. But, you know, Nashville, yeah, I've spent a fair amount of time in Nashville, playing gigs in Nashville and all of that stuff, and Knoxville and everything. And Nashville highways, they're kind of crazy. I mean, they're not super crazy. I mean, they're only Midwest crazy. But of all Midwest highways, they're amongst the more annoying, you know. And Nashville rush hour is definitely not a... it's definitely not nothing, that's for sure. So, yeah, and oh god, and Nashville's bad with like all the Spaghetti Junction kind of bullshit as well. And oh, I've got to know which lane to be in, and like, oh, I've got to fit myself in there, and you don't have the roll-on power to make it in there. Yeah, I could see this being not necessarily a great bike for that situation. So I'm not going to knock Brian on his early escalation from this. Did he need to go to 1.2 liters right away? Maybe not. But he's already there. He might as well fucking enjoy it. Like, you know, merging with traffic is now zero problem for him, right?
Well, again, my first public road experiences were a Ducati SS800. And my first bike was a CB1000.
Right. Which... oddly, making almost identical horsepower and torque numbers. Like,
there may be a 200-pound difference between the two.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, right? Yes. But, yeah, you know, the Ducati 800, it's weird because it's like definitely a full-on mean sport bike. Only like 85 horsepower. But again, like I said, 90 is really, like, you won't notice anything missing, especially if it's got big torque. You won't notice anything missing after that.
Like, actually, low-key, CB1000 and CB900, I would say are probably excellent first bikes.
Very forgiving. Very forgiving with the gear changes. Yeah.
Reasonable horsepower, pretty good torque. A bit heavy and ride smoothly. Power all across, you know, torque all across the power band.
Yeah. The Nighthawk was the same way, too. Okay. So I think we've broken down the G310R pretty good here.
Also, not a name that rolls off the tongue.
That's true. Yeah, there's some, you know, R3 just works. And, you know, we're all just used to saying CBR, right? But just,
well, we can't even deal with GSXR, and we have to shorten it to Gixxer.
It's, yeah, yeah, yeah. There's no way to shorten G310R. You have to just say it.
Yeah.
I guess you could say 310R, but still people aren't familiar enough with this bike in this category to know what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I've made the case.
Yeah, even the name sucks. Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's move on to the best bike in the world this week. And the best bike in the world this week is the Kawasaki ZL600 Eliminator. Now, I'm sure 99% of our listeners listen to Motorcycles and Misfits, and they were talking about this bike earlier this week. And yeah, I'll admit it. I just straight up stole the idea to talk about this bike from them because I was aware of this bike a long time ago, and it had just completely disappeared from my memory. And if you don't know more about it, it's a bike that will just completely just disappear off of your radar, right?
This looks like a Shadow with an inline four.
And that's kind of exactly what it is. Now, there was a ZL600 and a ZL900, but I think the ZL600 is way cooler.
Wait, is this like the cruiser equivalent of the DeVille?
No. Philosophically, this is completely different. So what this has is a GPZ 600 motor from the mid-80s, essentially. They started selling these in like the early 90s. All right. Now, first of all, I have to say, for all these weird like 80s, 90s mid-range cruisers, time in terms of styling has been the nicest to this one over pretty much all the other models, right? Mm-hmm. There's something a little Harley Softail about it with the upswept tail. The tank has a certain beefiness to it, and the way the console like kind of comes out of the middle of it just doesn't look so weird like it does on others. Even the riser seat having a very distinct, super sharp angle looks a lot different than those super cheesy King Queen risers that you see in a lot of these like 80s, 90s cruiser bikes, right?
Yeah.
And it looks at first very quick glance, it looks like it's making a lot of the styling mistakes that like the Ducati Indiana made. But when you take a second look at it, you're like, actually, no, that kind of looks good, right? So, you know, obviously the GPZ style 600 motor was sorted and, you know, has that certain look that you're used to, right? The side covers over the airbox have a pretty pleasing, nice little tight, you know, tidy shape to them. And the handlebars, while, you know, coming up in a very cruiser position and being pulled back a little bit, you know, it's not like on the, what was the Suzuki one where they just come back way too far? I can't remember the model, but it overall is a lot more pleasing than all of the others. So first of all, in its time and still existing today, it's easy on the eyes. It looks a lot better than a Nighthawk, right? I mean, I love Nighthawks, but the Honda Nighthawk is a styling disaster. Time has been kind to this one. And, you know, and even if you think about it, it looks very Honda Magna as well.
I may have a weird opinion on this, but I love the Nighthawk. Is it the 650 SC?
Oh, that's the 700 you're talking about.
Or the 700 with the black and blue, with the square headlight.
And the little mini bikini-ish fairing thing. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
I'm super in love with that bike, stylistically.
Yeah, that's a little aside. But yeah, I get what you're saying. But, you know, but yeah, time's also been a little bit kind to that one as compared to other ones. And this one fits in that category. So a lot of people can't bring themselves to be on these, like, you know, 85 to mid-90s sort of cruiser power-ish cruiser bikes because of the styling. But first of all, this one stands out just alone on being pretty easy on the eyes. Now, let's get into the performance. As we've stated in a lot of episodes, on a cruiser, you're really usually looking at somewhere around 60 horsepower, right? So this is making 74. And most importantly, this revs up to 10,500 RPM, which is a lot on a cruiser. Now, thinking back to our last episode where we were talking about torque and horsepower and revs and all that sort of stuff.
Well, this is crushing a modern 883 Sportster.
Oh, absolutely, in terms of the horsepower. Now, here's the thing. An 883 horsepower could not have a motor like this because it's too heavy.
You just said an 883 horsepower.
Sorry, an 883 Sportster. An 883 Sportster could not get away with having an inline 600 motor because it's too heavy, right? Mm-hmm. We were saying it's easier to take the big V-twin and put it in a sport bike than it is to take the higher revving sport bike motor and put it in a cruiser because of the weight. But this one comes in at 460 pounds. So a Kawasaki sport bike of this same year, a ZX6E, like I used to own, came in at 500 pounds. And that 40 foot-pounds of torque and that horsepower would move 500 pounds. Now, once you start getting north of 500 pounds, you start having big problems with not having enough torque. But 500 is kind of the magic number where you can still get away with around 40 to 45 foot-pounds of torque. That's just kind of how that works. It's not going to feel like big and brutish at all, but it's enough to make the experience work. And this comes in lower at 460 wet. So the torque is enough. And it's light enough that it still kind of moves the bike. Like when you crack the throttle, this is still going to have a little bit more of a jolt than even a 9600 Ninja. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, 74 horsepower, this thing's going to break 100 miles an hour. And it's a cruiser that you get to rev the shit out of. Is this going to be a VMAX experience? No. But this is what, if they made a 600 VMAX, this is what that would feel like.
When you really take the horsepower and the torque numbers on here, this is basically giving you the horsepower and the torque to weight ratio of a CB900, but 150 pounds lighter.
Yeah. It's very, very cool. And, you know, the only problem with this bike is that they didn't make very many of them. It was a little ahead of its time because Kawasaki is moving back towards this thing right now. If you look at the Vulcan S, it's a two-cylinder, but the revs, the torque, the horsepower are all still in the same sort of range. Now, the styling goes a little bit more towards like an Indian Scout. I mean, not exactly, but you know, it's low and it's long and it's beefy and chunky and everything. And this is sort of the 80s version of that, or 90s version of that. And
it's Kawasaki's also got some weird things going on stylistically with like the rear turn signals coming straight back out of the back of the subframe.
I like that.
I love it. I think it's great. But I've never seen like every bike of this generation, and for the two previous generations,
ridiculously long dorky stems coming out the side. Yeah,
but this has just got stock stems that come straight back out and are neat and tidy.
I'll give this thing another bike, this thing another styling award as well. The obviously late 80s, early 90s mag wheels on it actually look correct on this bike.
Normally, I hate the look of, like, three-spoke mag wheels. And this has three-spoke mag wheels front and rear.
Yep.
And it kind of pulls it off.
It does. Yeah, it really does. Now, again, they made a 900 version of this that was making, like, 100 horsepower and 60-something foot-pounds of torque that was really just, like, a badass bike that was very close to the VMAX experience.
Another weird thing, I think, for this generation is the matte black engine.
Yeah. Well, again, that 80s GPZ motor, they had already completely figured it out. And this was right before they were moving towards the full-on liquid-cooled and air-cooled and oil-cooled, like, super-duper, like, you know, hard cast aluminum casing version that went on to what was actually coming out at this time. So this is the older generation GPZ, like, you know, hadn't moved to the ZX model Ninja engines yet.
It is,
they were kind of getting the last thing they could out of those GPZ engines in these two bikes.
Right. What's also interesting, you can tell that to get the bike to rev that high with an air cooled motor, it has an oil cooler on the front of it that is about the size of a modern liquid-cooled radiator.
No, I think this is a liquid-cooled engine. It just has some fins to assist it as well.
Oh, it is liquid-cooled. Okay.
Yeah. No,
but it's just got the fins right, on it.
This doesn't have the oil cooler as well yet, though, like the ZX motors do is also.
Okay.
So like I said, this is an 80s motor in a 90s bike, but in an application that no one had really seen an inline four go into before. And now, like I said, what's important about this and why this is really the best bike in the world is we're starting to see some smaller capacity cruisers. Like I said, the Vulcan S, basically in philosophy, do exactly the same thing with a big styling update. And here's my prediction. You were complaining about the three valve Honda Shadow motor, right?
Right.
I think in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to see a parallel twin or four cylinder across the four frame Honda Shadow 600, 750, making very similar weight, horsepower, and torque numbers to this. I think as Harley decides to tell the public that,
well, they just take the giant cruisers motor.
aren't necessarily the be all and end all. Or yeah, or the 650F motor. Exactly. That would be perfect. That's making numbers just like this. Exactly. The 650F motor. We're going to see like a Shadow or maybe just another line of cruiser, although I think Harley will just scrap the whole Shadow line and then just reinvent it. Because how can they get rid of the Shadow name, right? Wait,
Harley?
Honda. Jeez. I am missaying things like crazy this week.
It's almost like a turn signal day.
Right? Yeah. I think we're going to see something like that from Honda. Yeah, 650F motor in like a Shadow sort of package. And I think we're going to see this return to the small mid-range cruiser, right? Because the worlds have gone so far apart in sport bike and cruiser, right? It's like you either have to work towards this giant cruiser on the Harley side or this super insane sport bike on the other side. And everyone in the middle has been forgotten about.
Right.
And really, you know, at heart, a lot of people want to live both worlds. A lot of people want the best of both worlds. And there is a formula to make that bike. And this bike is the perfect blueprint for it. You have to update a lot of things, right? You have to update the rear drum brake. You have to update the way it's cooled. You have to update the styling. But there's a lot of important things about this you can keep. And the Vulcan S does a very good job of that. And I think what we'll see from other manufacturers, right? Like, you know, could Indian do an 850 version of the Scout for a slightly less price, you know?
Right.
I think that's going to be a new entry level point, right? This is sort of a Moto Domus thing put in with the best bike in the world here. I think this very middle sized cruiser market is going to re-emerge. Because I think that's what a lot of people want.
It's an interesting proposition, because when you're looking at entry-level bikes, if you assume that like the Street 500 or the Shadow 750 are kind of the entry-level for the cruiser world, and you know the R3 and the Ninja 400 and whatever are the entry-level for the sport bike world, really, you're going to pick a bike and you don't know what you really want because you haven't experienced the whole, you don't get a really good wide breadth of experience on your first bike.
Yeah.
Because each one of these categories has become super polarized. So you're either just going to keep going with what you've already got and escalate in that class, or you have to make a radical shift to a different class of bike.
Yeah.
There is no really good middle ground unless you go up to and buy something like a CB650F, which is a standard bike with an inline four that kind of straddles that middle ground. And if you want to buy in entry level for $7,000, like, okay. But that's kind of where you've got to go.
But you, the Vulcan-S hits that. The Vulcan-S comes in at somewhere around 8, 8.5 brand new. They're starting to creep down because I think they came out in 2015, maybe 2016, but I think 2015. You can start getting ones now at about 6.5 grand used. And the great thing about them is that as a cruiser that you can put bags on, doesn't come with the baggage of owning a cruiser. It's a little smaller, but it's not small like a Rebel 250. It's a legit bike, right? There are a couple faults on this one. Some people claimed, like, you know, it wasn't super comfortable if you were a taller person, right? Getting that 600 and getting the weight down, right? But you know what? Bikes in general were super fucking crazy heavy back then. There's a way to make a 450-pound bike of the same dimensions now that allows for more, you know, leg room and everything for your controls and all that stuff. The metallurgy, the lighter materials, it's all there now, right?
Right.
The only problem with this bike is that it was a little ahead of its time. Because instead of going on for the full power cruiser thing that was popular at the time, this one went to be a sensible middleweight cruiser. And while it was, you know, aimed at being competition for the 883, which it definitely was very good competition for, you know, by the 90s, Harley was becoming, you know, Harley like we know him. Like, you know, hey, if it ain't a Harley, it's bullshit. And by then it was too late. If Kawasaki had been able to do something very similar to this with, again, a version of the old Z motors, not the GPZ motors, then I think they would have been able to crush the 883 Sportster in sales, and this would have really taken off. And there was a way to do that at somewhere, probably towards higher 60s in horsepower rather than mid-70s. But in any case, it's a blueprint for the future, because I think this market is going to like just come back in a real big way. People are getting a little tired of retro bikes. People are getting a little tired of big, heavy cruisers. People are getting tired of sport bikes. People are even starting, I'm noticing, a little less zeal for the big adventure bikes. You know, like
the big adventure bike backlash. Actually, I think you're a little bit slow to the party here, because the backlash for the big adventure bike started like 3 years ago, and now it's back on the upswing.
Well, yeah, but the guys that buy them are like older dudes that really just don't care what's cool or hip.
You mean people with money?
Exactly, right. So more affordable middle-range cruisers, it's going to be this sort of get back to America and cruisers, but it doesn't have to be American. It's more practical, but it's still a cruiser. I think it's perfect moving forward. And this is a blueprint for that. And I think this is going to I think this is what everyone that bought an R3 is going to kind of move to. When they're like, yeah, I tried out a 600 and the seating position is not comfortable. The R3 led me to believe that sport bikes are more comfortable than they actually are. You know, that sort of thing. I think we'll see people moving to shit like the Vulcan-S and, fingers crossed, Honda don't let me down, a Shadow with an inline 4 across it. It's somewhere around 700 cc's, you know, something like that. Again, Honda, if you're not already working on this project, fucking hire us. Like we've told you to a million times. And with that, I'm just going to say Kawasaki ZL600, not the 900, ZL600 Eliminator. Also, badass name. Best bike in the world this week. Let's take a little break. Okay, and we're back. So, let's see. We're at like an hour and... we're past an hour and a half or something. I don't know if we got really enough time to run into another subject. I don't know if we need to run that long on this episode. We tend to be breaking like 2 hours a lot lately on this show, which I think a lot of people like the long form, but I don't know. Well, the other things I want to talk about, I think, take like a substantial amount of time. But I do want to read a couple reviews that we've gotten lately. So this one says, want to have a beer with dot, 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 from Bojax34. He says, I don't know why this works or why I enjoy it so much, but I do. Learned a lot about bikes, listening to the podcast. I do wish the guys would keep in mind that not all their listeners are as up to speed as they are when rattling off bike models, etc. Remember that we might not even know what brand of bike you're talking about. Clue us in a little more. Other than that, love it. Okay, to speak to that, it's a little tricky because I guess everyone listening to motorcycle podcasts, there's, you know, people listening that are very new and people that have been riding for a long time. And yeah, it's hard to strike a balance of what kind of information you're giving out. So we just try to just talk about everything we can possibly talk about. But
I love that we're pushing back against 5-star reviews here. So I guess this is something that is, yeah, it's a little tricky to just in with every single bike to kind of, you know, really flesh out exactly what it is. It can be a little tricky sometimes, and that's kind of a limitation of the medium. One thing I will say that is, if you're not wrenching on your bike or doing something else while you're listening to the podcast, we do put at least pictures of the best and worst bike in our show notes.
Yeah, so look for that.
And we do put them as links, so I don't know if those show up in iTunes or not. I guess we should check that out.
They should. They do on my phone, so.
Okay. So normally if you're on your phone, and you're listening through iTunes, you should at least be able, and I would assume on most platforms, you should be able to at least pull up the picture of the bike. And we usually go into horsepower and torque.
Well, and weight and a bunch of other things, gearing sometimes, all sorts of specs about it. But, you know, I get where this guy's coming from. You know, we just like dive deep into stuff when we start talking really fast. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know, we kind of live and breathe this stuff, so it's a little hard for us to, I guess, dumb it down at times. But, you know, but basically, Bojax, thank you for the 5-star review and totally noted. And then here we go. We've got another one called, another 5-star review that says, almost always interesting, from Gary N42. It says, occasionally runs a little long on discussion of Moto 2 or something like that, but usually stays interesting even with that. Hey, badass. So, you know, he's recognizing that we ramble on a bit, which, yeah, we definitely do. But, you know, he loves the long form anyway, which I think most people do. So, hey, guys, thank you for that. Now, speaking of iTunes reviews, we've been brainstorming here a little bit, and, you know, we've asked you guys to send us in some ideas for best and worst bike, and we've actually decided to up the game a little bit on that, just a little bit more. So, since we have a lot more listeners than we have iTunes reviews still, we've decided we'll run this for a few weeks before we make a decision, but here we go. Write us the most insane review you can. Entertaining, off the wall, weird and wacky. We're not going to give you any direction. Just go for it. Okay?
Let's put the one caveat that the review needs to not get filtered by Apple.
Yeah. Make it one that'll actually show up. And then after that, send us an email with your iTunes handle. You know, and you go ahead and include, like, you know, your name and what you ride and all that sort of stuff. And then after a few weeks, we're going to choose the best iTunes review, right? So we probably won't read iTunes reviews for a few weeks just while we're sorting out who's sending the best one. Give it a little bit of time, right? And then after that, if we choose your iTunes review as the most entertaining to us review that there could ever possibly be, we'll send you a call in time. We'll have you on the show and you can choose best or worst bike in the world this week, lay out the case, and we'll just talk it out with you, dude, and we'll go from there. So since, you know, since best worst bike seems to be the thing that everyone, you know, enjoys the most, that's the part that we should bring someone in on, I think. So at least for that portion of the show, and who knows, if you're funny as fuck or just, you know, a character in one way or another, you know, we might just have you on for the rest of the show in general. Like, who knows, right? We'll get you matched up with us on Discord, and we'll have you, yeah, we'll get you to call in and whatever. We record at a pretty regular time every week. This shouldn't be too difficult. When we record, I think, is a pretty manageable time for most people. So there we go. That's our contest. And I think that I'm hoping our listeners are, into us enough to be tickled a little bit by that. So let's see. Anything else that we want before we close this one out?
I will just say, I'm a little disappointed that we haven't had any good hate mail yet.
Yeah, well, we had the 1 2-star review, which really, I loved that. Yeah, yeah.
But a 2-star review doesn't count as hate mail.
It's true, it doesn't. Hate mail would be fantastic as well. That would really tickle me. But, okay, so after that, I think we're pretty much done here, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's run the outro. I'm going to remind you guys to, again, send us reviews and emails and everything like that. Send us ideas for best worst bike, or give us your review so you might be able to get on the show. All that good stuff. And I'll remind you to stay safe and stay tuned. Let's hit it.
And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle.